All right. This is the third week on Perek Bet on Chapter 2. We're going to finish Chapter 2, I expect, this week. And then we'll start on the discussion of ethnic cleansing, which is a terrible discussion, but you have to have it because you can't read Sefer Yehoshua and pretend it's not an issue. What we're looking at now starts with Pasuk Tet Vav. At this point, the spies came to the house. They didn't get a chance to do anything, apparently, before the king found out. The king immediately sent people to the house. Rahab hid them in the house. We saw her hide them twice, apparently. She, at least according to the Abarbanel's read, keeps the king's people outside and just hides them a second time for greater security up on the roof. And she tells them, we're frightened because of all the things that have gone on. We're frightened about the way that you that Hashem split the Yam Suf. We're frightened because of what you did to Sichon and Og. We're frightened because you took the spoils. All the different tiers who are frightened. We talked about the leadership being frightened. We talked about the rank and file being frightened. And so she says, I recognize that God is really God, and I want you to return the favor that I did by saving me and saving my family. And we talked about chesed and emet, how on the one hand she is owed chesed because she did something above and beyond for them, and that's what she asks for her family, but for herself it's emet, it's truth, because I saved you, you saved me. That was where we left things. And the men agreed with the deal. And then we get to Pasuk Tet Vav, sentence 15. Do you need a sheet? If you don't remember that from last time, don't worry. It's been 2 weeks, and we did Purim last week, so don't feel bad. V'taridim b'chevel be'ad ha'chalon. So she lowers them from the window via a rope. Right? Why is she lowering them via a rope? Because they can't go out the front door. Right? That's not happening. So she lowers them instead via a rope out the window. Ki beisa bekira choma uva choma hi yoshaves, because her house is right on the wall. She is living on the wall. Now here's an odd turn of phrase, right? It says, it seems to say, her house is on the wall and she's living on the wall. It seems redundant. Is that how your translations have it? The end of Pasuk Tet Vav?
Her house is on a wall from the fortification, and she lived in the fortification.
Yeah, so that's fairly redundant, no? I would have known she lived in the fortification from the first clause.
Well,
why not?
She could be within the walls, but she's on the other side. No, but she's within the walls, but it could be anywhere. She's actually on the edge. Her house is on the wall.
But wasn't that what the first phrase said? I mean, obviously she's within the walls of the city, or you wouldn't have this whole discussion about them having left the city and the people going out to chase after them.
Okay.
Right, you know she's inside the city already.
Right.
That's the art school translation. What about the others?
Her house was on the town wall, and she dwelt upon the wall.
Yeah, same problem. It's fundamentally the same problem. So that the one approach, which Abarbanel gives, is that that's not the way to read the last three words in a sentence. Admittedly, the way they're reading it seems to me to fit Pshat better in terms of what the words mean in the sentence, but because it's redundant, he reads the last three words to mean she's sitting on the wall. Yoshav is like Yoshav, meaning to sit.
Like watching?
Like watching them, exactly, because of what's going to come next. This is now setting up the scene. The scene is they're lowered out the window because her house is on the wall of the city, so now they're outside of the city, and she is sitting there watching them. And then we get the conversation that comes next. So Barbanel's resolving this redundancy. But let's see what happens now in Pasuk Tet Zayin. By the way, why is her house on the wall? Why does that make sense for her to be on the wall?
People
are able to come to her in secret, people from outside. It offers an avenue of escape if someone has to get out. All these different options. Vatomer Lahem, Hahara Lechu. She says to them, go to the mountain, lest the pursuers catch you. V'nach beisem shama shloshes yamim, hide there for 3 days. Ad shov harodfim, until the pursuers come back. V'achar telchu ledarkechem, and then go on your way. That's her advice to them for how to get out. That's a really interesting thing that she does there, right?
She seems to know exactly what they will do.
How do you know it's going to be 3 days? Where'd you get that information from? It's going to take them 3 days to search, so they're going to come home. Well, granted that 3 days is a magic period of time in Tanakh. Right? Those of you who have been in other classes where we talked about 3 days. 3 days is a magic period of time in Tanakh. What are some of the three-day periods that come up in Tanakh?
Before Matan Torah.
Right. They prepare for 3 days to get the Torah. What else? We just celebrated Purim. Mm-hmm.
Oh,
3 days before she goes to Achashverosh, that's right. I know, we're in Pesach mode already, I get it.
Can we cut that to 3 days?
Yeah.
Nope. But it takes them 3 days to get to Yam Suf, right? 3 days to get to the sea. That's another example. Where else do we find 3 days? Yonah is in the fish for 3 days.
Didn't the Malachim come
that day? Right, 3 days for Avram after the Brit Milah, before the Malachim show up. 3 days comes up over and over and over again within Tanakh. 3 days until they get to the Akedah. Right? Also, there's a reference in Hosea to returning to life after 3 days, which the Christians took in their own direction. There are all sorts of three-day references in Tanakh. 3 days seems to be sort of the period of time before the next phase. And there's a lot of discussion you can have about that. It's called a liminal transition. There's a lot you can do with it, but I'm just noting here that she reads their minds and understands it's going to be 3 days. Whether it's because she's read Tanakh and knows that everything takes 3 days, or whether it's because 3 days just means a random period of time. The problem is it can't mean a random period of time because it matters for the chronology of the story, as we're going to see. So, take a look, please.
What are the distance from where the mountains are and how far in general they pursue people and then come back?
Because this happens all the time.
I don't know. Maybe there's other...
She's
why
very
part
well
of,
yeah. What...
She knows the
protocol. She knows they only brought enough food and supplies for 3 days or whatever.
Yeah, maybe. But it's all possible. Take a look at your sheet. First of all, source number one. Before we get to numbers two and three, source number one is the Gemara on lowering them out of the window. It's a very interesting statement. After it comments on what she's been doing for 40 years, it says, "Achar nun shana nisgaira." After she's 50 years old, she converts to Judaism. Amra, she said, "Yeh machuli bischar chevel chalon upishtim." May it all be forgiven, everything that she's been involved with, in exchange for the rope, the window, and the flax. The rope and the window that she had used previously to lower people out, she's now used to save the spies. The flax had been used to hide people on the roof before, now it was used to hide the spies. So she says, I'm now using everything for the good. That's one point. The second point, though, is this business of the 3 days. Take a look at two different approaches. Source number two, Don Isaac Abarbanel, who likes to be a literalist. So Abarbanel says, V'haya migodel sichla shehigvila shloshes yamim lachazaras harodfim v'kein haya. She's bright. She figured out, yeah, it's probably 3 days till they come back. And not only is she bright enough to figure it out, but she's gutsy enough to actually bank their lives on it. Right? She's not just saying, I think it's going to be 3 days. She's saying, okay, you have 3 days and then you're going to be safe. And if they come out and then they're caught, it's because she gauged wrong. So that's a difficult thing to do, but she does it. And then Abarbanel also quotes for us a medrash, which offers a different take, source number three. Magid shasharas aleha ruach hakodesh. This shows that she actually experienced divine inspiration. She'ilu lo sharas aleha ruach hakodesh me'ayin haisa yodah she'asidim lachzer lachar shloshi yamim. Because if she doesn't have divine inspiration, then how does she know that they're not coming back, that it's going to be 3 days, and then after 3 days it's going to be safe? Where in the world does she get that from? So the Medrash understands that she is a prophetess. She's a Nevi'ah. Interesting. I'm going to come back to that point. But so far what we have is advice from Racha for them to escape the search. She manages to save them. She uses the what had previously been used for the trade, she now uses for them. And she says, 3 days, and then you're going to be safe, either because she figures it out or because she has some kind of prophecy. Then we find round two of the negotiations, this time instigated by the spies.
Vayomru eleha ha'anashim. Once they're already on the other side of the wall, they're shouting out to her?
Yeah. Doesn't sound very bright, no?
Yeah,
I know how tall the wall is.
It can't be very private conversation.
Right. Although, I mean, if she considered it a safe place in general for people to flee, maybe it was.
There was no other windows or people around.
Right. I mean, as a general rule, you don't put windows in the wall of the city. Right? It's a bad idea. It makes you vulnerable. The wall of the city is your defense. People can shoot in arrows. They can scale the wall. You don't want windows. It's kind of funny that she has one, although, you know, she clearly had an easement for commercial purposes.
Right.
But
she had it rezoned.
Right. But I'm guessing that there aren't in general, and the guards are all gone, right? Because the guards are all chasing their wild goose chase. They're off running after spies. So you're right. It's kind of funny to have this dialogue going on. I do have to think that the wall isn't that high. But here's what happens. By Amuri Leha Ha'anashim, the men say to her, Nikiyim Anachnu Mishvoseh Chaza Asher Hishbatanu. Fooled you, they say. We are clean of any oath that you made us swear. So there. Pasuk Yuched, it doesn't end there. Sentence 18. Hine Anachnu Ba'im Ba'aretz. We're going to come into the land. As tikvas chut hashani azet tikshiri b'chalon asher haredetenu vo. Tie this string, this red string. The word tikvat is a funny word here. How do they translate tikvat in your Tanakh?
Cord.
The cord of...
Scarlet thread.
No, before it says to tie... Wait. Before it says to tie it, right before that.
When we come into the land, you shall tie.
Bind?
Right, you shall bind the scarlet thread, that's what it says?
Yeah.
I would say they take the word tikva to be to bind, to tie. Okay, so the problem is that people instinctively want to translate tikvat as the hope of, but it doesn't make any sense in terms of the sentence. So that's what I thought when you were reading it. When people said it means to bind, I didn't understand how that fit, and that's why I said go earlier in the sentence. Rashi says tikvat is from the word kav, like a line. So tikvat chut hashani, this line of red string, you shall tie on the window asher haredetenu bo, from which you lowered us. That's the idea. And then ves avich ves imech ves achayach ves kol beis avich hasvi alayach habayta. Your father, your mother, your brothers, your whole household, gather them into the house with you. Okay. First of all, this is not the basis for the red string thing. The whole red bendel thing. No. I refuse any association. What do you mean?
Oh. Sorry, forget it.
No, why would it be?
Didn't you say the red bendel is not the thing they tie around Kevaracha?
Right. Kevaracha. People say, right, they talk about doing that. Where does that come from? Right. So right.
They need money. They
so the answer seems to be, well, it's shrouded in mystery and we don't know and so on. However, there's a Tosefta. Tosefta is uncanonized Mishnah that was later collected. So this is something you're talking about 2,000 years old, in which the opinion is stated that tying a red string is Darkei Amori. It is a pagan way. It's associated with the Canaanites. It's not a Jewish thing to do. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, Rav Moshe Stern, the Debrecino Rav, a serious Hungarian Rav, writes, this is something that the women have, that they've been doing, and it's very old, and therefore you shouldn't question it, and you shouldn't make fun of it. It's simply something that they do, and therefore we continue to do it. There must be meaning behind it, even if we don't necessarily know. So you have, on the one hand, the tendency to say, this isn't one of ours, it's some kind of pagan thing, and then on the other hand, because people do it, and pious people do it, so leave it be. Either way, I'm only mentioning it here because once you mention Rachav with the red string, you can't ignore red string. Hey, maybe there's something to it. No, there isn't. Anyway,
what about a connection to the Yom Kippur service?
Right, so that's one that people like to quote, is the idea that it's tied to the goat that goes over the edge. The problem is that we don't really want to tie that onto our children, do we? No, I'm not making fun. Half of it is tied to the goat, half of it is tied in the Beis HaMikdash. Yeah, maybe that's the association. But we associate red with guilt usually. Right? If your sins are red like, then they're going to be, they'll be made white like snow. So
it's always like some word of Ayin Hara of some sort.
Yes. Yeah, but what does that mean?
I know. I don't know. It's red, not part of
the. There's a lot more to say about it, but that was just a side note. The statement here that they make is that she should take this red thread and tie it on the window, and take a look at source number 4. Source number 4 is from a fascinating medrash on Eishes Chayil. This medrash in Mishle goes line by line and associates each line with a different woman from Tanakh and her particular righteousness. So on the line, Lo sira lebeisa mishale ki chove sa lavush shanim, she is not afraid for her household from snow because her household is clothed in red wool. So the Midrash says, Zo Rachav Hazona. That's Rachav. Bisha Shabo Yisrael Hachriv Yericho, Lo Nisyar Amehem. When the Jews came to destroy Yericho, she was not afraid. Mibnei Shanasnu La Siman Estikvas Chut Hashani, because they had given her this sign, this red string. So they associated it with Rachav, which is very important because it's part of a theme that we're going to see here of seeing Rachav as this very righteous, very pious person. We've seen a few items already today. I want to connect the dots soon. But they say to Rachav, put this red string outside your window, gather your household, all the people you mentioned, your parents, your siblings, into the house, and then Pasuk Yutet, sentence 19, V'haya, kol asher yetze midalsei v'esei hachutza damo v'rosho v'anachnu nikiyim. If during the invasion some member of your household is foolish enough to venture outside, his blood's on his own head. That's not our problem. Yeah.
But why are they saying we're poor from the promise you made? Because if you look back on what she extracted from them as a promise, how is that different? In other words, they're saying we're going to do this for you, but you were released from the promise, but that kind of is what the promise was.
Good question. What's the answer? It's a good question, right? They're agreeing to the same thing that they agreed to inside anyway.
They're just clarifying. They're just adding caveats, type thing.
Well, there's no caveats been added other than put the red string out.
No, we're not personal, so we have the personal liability as opposed to
what? Like, what did they have inside that they've now changed? I think they're making a valid point to her,
they can't control everything 100%.
Well, they haven't said that.
They're just saying, you tried to force us to make a promise. We are punted from that promise because it was done through force, but we still are going to honor it because we want to, not because you forced us to do it.
Exactly.
So it's sort of taking
under duress.
Yeah. So now, you were forcing us to say that we would do this. But that's not good enough. This way you really know that we are doing it of free will and that we are taking it seriously because it's our own choice.
Because now they're outside. They're not,
which is why they're
not
actually
being
outside.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
Exactly. Take a look. I'll jump the source to show you inside.
It's more genuine now. Like it's
she can trust it.
Right. Trustworthy.
Take a look at number 6, please. Ralbag on this. Rabbi Levi Ben Gershom. He says, this is part of, remember I mentioned the last time we saw Ralbag, that at the end of each few chapters, he presents lessons you can learn from the stories, and the lessons are often very pragmatic. So here he says, "V'hu she'ein ra'oi she'kapeach sechar kol bria." He says, you learn here that you shouldn't cheat anyone of their reward. "Ach ra'oi she'shulam gemul al kol ma'asei tov." Reward has to be paid for every good deed. And so you find that Yeshua instructed to keep Rachav alive, as well as everybody with her in the house. And the reason that Yeshua is going to give in chapter 6 when he explains why they're doing this, his reason is because she hid the people Yeshua sent. We said Malachim does not mean Malachim, it's the spies. And Yeshua isn't even going to say it's because of the oath of the spies. The reason we're doing it is not because we're obligated to. The reason we're doing it is because it's the right thing to do. And then you look at Abarbanel in source number 7, in which he explains the double negotiation. He says, Lefisha hayame haddin v'aderach hamuskal, he says, by law and logic, any vow you take when you're bound, when you're compelled, isn't valid. So when they left the house, and they were already outside of the city, they said to her, Right? They said to her, don't think that the vow we took when we were hidden on the roof is valid. It's not so. We are exempt from the oath you made us take there because we were compelled. But now, we're now free, we're acting on our own. Now we'll do this anew. That's why we're doing it. We're doing it because it's the right thing to do. We're not doing it because you forced us to. What you said, what you did before, is nothing. That's their statement to her. Even though what they were going to agree to is exactly the same thing that they had agreed to inside. They've added the sign, and they added the warning of, if somebody leaves the house, it's not our problem. Because it's not. So continuing here in Pasuk Chaf, they do add one other note, reasonable. Vim takidi es divareinu zeh, if you tell anybody about this, right? Oh, look, it's my cousin. So, v'hayinu nikiyim mishvoseh asher hishbatanu. We are then innocent of the oath you made us swear.
How would they know? Because if she finds Larry, Moe, and Curly and brings them into her house,
right?
They won't know because they're in the house.
Correct. And hypothetically true. Meaning she could say, look, here are my 12 brothers.
My family just got picked up.
But does that mean necessarily that she's telling people to bring them into the house to save them? Or is she telling people that in order maybe to get them into trouble and then... And then maybe, you know, if that's the case, then we become, we're going to try to save you and something happens and we're, you know, ambushed or whatever, then we're not guaranteeing anything that happens after that.
Right. That's interesting. I suppose it's possible. They say here, Devarenu Zeh, which really makes me think this specific agreement.
Right.
But I hear.
Say that you made us swear. They already allowed that oath. I mean, at the end of this, you have made us swear.
Right.
But they already absolved us both from what she made them swear. Now they're swearing their own.
That's interesting.
I mean, they already did that.
Right. Unless they just mean the whole deal. In other words, we made a deal when we were in the house. We got out of the house and we said, that's not binding, but we're going to agree to the same terms.
Right, but the lesson is that you made us swear.
Yeah, it is a funny, you're right, the wording is funny.
I also think you have to include the whole situation of when they came, what happened, and so if she, let's say the police come back to her and they say, you know, you have these guys here, we're going to torture you to tell us what happened, and she tells them, and then they decide to try to use it somehow as an ambush, okay, well now we're cutthroat because we're not...
You know, what I'm saying is
that way encompasses the whole situation of that she made them swear and then they said they would and then they,
No, Lee was right. I think those three words are strange. We can explain them, but they're strange.
Right.
I think that's true. So, Pasuk Chaf Aleph, sentence 21, Rachav accepts the terms. Vatomer, and she said, Kidibrechem kenhu. As you said, that's how it will be. Vatishalachim, she sends them away. Vayelechu, they go. Vatikshoret tikvas hashani b'chalon, and she ties the string on the window. Now, when is this invasion happening?
3 days.
No. At least 3 days. Right. At least 3 days, and it's going to be.
Is that
she's
already out there now?
Like,
what if somebody sees it? What are they going
to? So why did she put this thing out now?
To show that she's keeping up her end of the bargain.
Maybe.
Well,
so you're like, I could lose it, you know, who knows what's going to happen, I don't know when they're coming.
Forget to do it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people get busy.
But what if somebody sees it? Why do you have this? Like, what's going on here?
It's a big decoration.
Is it like a sort of signing the bargain, kind of or something like that?
That's interesting. So it's sort of a demonstration. Oh, the problem is they're already gone. It says she sent them, they went, and then she hid it. Take a look at source number 5. Abarbanel sees it as sort of the opposite of Roberta's concern. He says this is meant to avoid that problem. He says, V'achshov, and I think, Sheyomar shehi berov da'ata lo chifsa likshor tikvas hashani bizman. You can't read the English ahead of me. That's not fair. Lo chifsa likshor tikvas hashani bizman melchama. It's like going to a movie in Israel and reading the laughing and no one else can hear the dialogue. Lo chifsa likshor tikvas hashani bizman melchama ve'es hatzarech levad. So he says, I think it's telling you that because she's so smart, she doesn't wait to tie the string at the time of war when she needs it. Because everyone's going to realize, hey, there's an invasion going on, and this woman's out there tying a string. What's a string if not a symbol for those who are invading? And the people are going to kill her. So she ties it from then and leaves it up so that no one will realize. This has been there forever. That's the idea. Frankly, I would still want to wait if I were her, just because people who think like that the spies had been there.
Right, because it's like right away when there's all of what is commotion in her house, so like, she's like bringing attention to herself a little more. Right,
it is still a little bit strange.
Like the next day, maybe?
Right. It is still a little bit strange. I would worry that people who think she had spies in her house are going to read this as something. You're right. It is difficult. Okay. So what we've seen, this is it for Rachav's role in the Perek. Like the Perek is, Rachav is now done. But now we're going to follow up on the deal that's been made. Hello. Pasuk Chav Beis, sentence 22. Vayelchu vayavau hahara vayeshvu sham shloshes yamim ad shavu harodfim. So they went, they came to the mountain, they stayed there for 3 days until the pursuers had returned, because sure enough, she's right. They look all over the path, they don't find them. Levakesh does not literally mean to make a request. This is worth knowing in general about Levakesh. Levakesh is to want something, to seek something. Sometimes that's a verbal request, sometimes it's not. So we don't actually know that they were inquiring of people, but they sought the spies, they didn't find them. Pasuk Chav Gimel, Vayashuvu Shneha Anashim Vayardume Hahar. The two men then came out of the mountain. Vayavru Vayavo El Yoshua Benun. They crossed the Yarden. They go to Yoshua. Vayisakru Lo Eskol HaMotzaos Osam. And they told him everything that had happened. Vayomru El Yoshua. And they said to Yoshua, Ki Nasan Hashem Biyadeinu Eskol HaAretz. God has given us the land. And everybody has melted away before us. So Ralbag sees this as evidence that their mission was not military reconnaissance. It wasn't how do I get into the city. It was to get a sense of morale, right? Which we saw, as opposed to the view that said it was an attempt to figure out the best way in which case it's a complete failure. Right? If this is a military mission, it's a bust. If it's a mission of, let me see how the sense of the land, what people are doing, then it's a success. So it all depends on which version of things you have.
It's funny, because they didn't do that much spying. They went to one person and then hopefully got the information.
Well, they got found out right away, so they didn't have time to do it.
She's the one who knows what's going on in town. So.
Right. They believed that this was the right way to go.
But they also would find out, you would go all the way there.
Yeah,
speak to one person
opinion.
And just turn around and leave, right?
Yeah, it is. The answer is
they're
stuck.
The first taxi driver, and then you're done, right?
Keep in mind, according to the view that it was a military thing, that would be consistent with Abarbanel's point, when Abarbanel said they were wrong for going to her house, and that's how they got found out. So in other words, it's possible to read this story as, in fact, a failure. Correct. Another mission of spies that didn't work. Is how we could legitimately read this.
But when they came back and told Yoshua, was not like if it was a military thing and they came back and said we have no idea how to get it back in, we got found out right away, then that would indicate it. But their response and their report
is at least they're positive.
But you're going to want to give. Yeah. Aren't you kind of thinking they had a couple days to think about it and talk about it?
How are we going to present it? Right.
We're going to present it in the best light. Like,
but there's still no military information to give over.
Like, right, because they don't have any, so they're not going to say, oh, we didn't really get that. Right. We only got this. So they're kind of giving you, they're spinning this.
They wanted, they only have one person's account.
Correct.
So even if you're going to say that it was a morale expedition and they just wanted to know what was going on, like morale, they also only have one opinion.
They have more than one opinion. They're going to tell them,
well, look, they knew we were there.
Yeah.
And they're expecting something to happen.
Right.
So
it's not just one opinion. Yeah. They have the evidence we pointed out last time about the king's reaction to news that there are Israelites there, this sudden panicked reaction, I think that's part of the picture. So there is that to go on as well. Okay. Summarizing the perek then, what has this perek taught us about Yehoshua? Obviously, you'd have to go back to the very beginning of the perek because he hasn't appeared since. But remembering way back when.
He picked two honest men, obviously, because they, you know, you see how they acted at the end.
Right.
What they did was right, so he picked people that were trustworthy.
He has a good sense of the people he's working with. Fair. The decision to send spies.
Yeah. Also, it was maybe a good decision to just keep it quiet.
Right. He's calculating. He does it quietly as opposed to what happened the first time around. He's pragmatic. He's not afraid of failure, which really, to me, is a big deal. Right? I mean, we talked about in the first parak, you know, this constant theme of the fear of taking over for Moshe. And he's doing that which didn't work out for Moshe. That takes a degree of courage, you know, for him to go out there in his first act as a leader. Granted, he doesn't tell anybody, because if it's a bust, they don't need to know. But I think that that's an interesting thing that he does. And in chapter 6, when they invade, he's going to honor the commitment to Rahav, which shows that he's not greedy and that he's not brutal. He's going to be...
Vulnerable.
Yeah, he's fair, exactly. Now, what does the story tell us about Canaan?
Paranoid.
Well, you're not paranoid if they really are out to get you, right?
Terrified.
They're reasonably afraid. What else? Go back to Rahav. Right? It tells us about the morality of the society, right? Taking Rahav as a 10-year-old kid and putting her into this career, plus the way the language was written to match the language of Sodom, right? And the response of Sodom when Lot has guests in his house, same language that's used here when they want the guests, spies, out of Rahav's house. It's meant to tell us, yeah, these people are like Sodom. This is a message about Canaan. Don't forget that, because it's going to be very important. Sorry?
They're going to deserve what
yeah.
Get with it. Get what they deserve.
The people who made her do this at age 10 and whatever, that was, 40 years ago?
Yeah.
Is the government the same? Is everybody the same? Are we assuming that it's the exact same society for all those years?
So that's a really interesting question, I think.
She's been doing it for a million years. It's already what she's doing.
No, it's a very good question. The assumption we tend to make, biblically, is that for all of our wonderful talk about tshuva and people can grow and change and be different, societies don't.
And also 40 years is not a long period of time in a society.
Well, it's a generation.
It's, for them, it's a generation, close to two.
Yeah.
The thing is, though, and just looking at it without agreeing or disagreeing with the principle, we find consistently through Tanakh that Esav's descendants are Esav's descendants from the beginning to the end. Yishmael and his crew, they're going to be the same way down the line. The Jews themselves, right? The first generation leaves Egypt. The next generation that actually enters into Israel looks awfully similar. They have been given lessons, and they've been told explicitly they have to change. The reality is that biblical society is assumed to be static, barring some cataclysmic change. And even then, I wouldn't give you odds. I think we do look at them. Canaan is the best example of all. Because when we start talking about the ethnic cleansing issue, one of the points that we're going to have to discuss is the way that Canaan is assumed to be consistent since the days of its founder, Canaan, down to this point in history. So yeah, there is this idea that sort of Masa Avos Simon Labanim as a historical assertion, that what happened with the ancestors is going to happen with the kids. The importance, though, of knowing this about Canaan is not only in order to justify what's going to happen to them here, but it's also important because the Jews are warned repeatedly, this is what Canaan is like, don't be like them. So recording this in Yehoshua is part of teaching us, this is what the neighborhood is like. You're coming into this land, don't be like them. It's a warning. So that's in terms of Canaan. And then, after all of this, who is Rahav? Right? She is certainly seen as clever under pressure, right? When she responds instantly to the king's men, keeping them outside and hiding the spies, and responding wisely to them, pretending that she's on their side instead of trying to hide and lie. She goes on the offensive, we saw, regarding the open gate of the city as part of getting them to go out and close the gate and sending them off on their chase. Not to mention coming up with this 3-day estimate, which is pretty sharp. But you could read this story, and I asked this question when we began this. You could read the story either as Rahav is a pragmatic sellout who is betraying her city to save herself and her family, or you could read it as she's a very righteous lover of the Jews. What would you say, having that read?
In between, because she grew up in a society that we're saying has no morality, has no loyalty, is out for themselves anyway, right? And you see that because of what they made her put her, you know, what position they put her in. So she realizes that the only person she can rely on in order to save herself is herself, and to do what she can to do that. And she also, from the stories that she's hearing of the Jews, she's hearing of a different kind of society that may honor them, you know, their promises, and may, you know, be more moral, and therefore she's counting on that. And so she's being smart. Like, it's just the smart thing, not necessarily that she's being either disloyal to her community, because she never had loyalty to her community, because they never... Nobody had loyalty in that society, it sounds like. Right, so she's just basically thinking, you know, being smart and trying to do what's best for herself, as she always had to do, and be the smart businesswoman she's been.
Right.
And in actual fact, can you blame her? I mean, is that such a terrible thing to do?
No, nothing. Just maybe it's not.
No, it's the rules of the game.
We do whatever we have to do to survive.
Right.
Right. So you could definitely read it that way. I think that's a legitimate read.
And also almost like, you know, for someone who has been put in her position at age 10... It sounds like she has been smart all her life, a smart businesswoman all her life, and a smart person, that she's created this position for herself within that society. Like, people, you know, she is doing a good business, right? She's making something for herself. She has her own place in the wall and whatever, and so she obviously has been smart all along. Whereas her other options could have been, she could have just, you know, been, you know, somebody... You know, like, yeah, the drugs of society kind of thing, and have nothing, and, you know, and she obviously is her own boss, her own person, and she's in that position because she doesn't have anything else to do, but she's obviously made herself, like, she's been a smart person all along, it sounds like, to build herself up.
And that's, I think that's fair. On the other hand, now we've seen a pattern of ways in which the Chachamim look at this. We saw it from the beginning, and see her as a particularly righteous person. The way that they see Rahav is, from the beginning, when we talked about her being on that great list of four, right, where we grouped her with Sarah, and we grouped her with Chava, and we grouped her Chava wasn't on the list, Sarah, Abigail, and Esther. We see it in her recognition of God in the Pasuk explicitly, right, in Pasuk Yud Aleph, where I think it was Yud Aleph, where she says that God is the God above, and so on. They talk about her as a prophetess. They include her in Eshes Chayil. Like, they look at her as righteous. Now, one other note, which I think is worth pointing out, is that when you look at the failure of Parshat Shlach with those spies, and the success of these spies, what's the major difference? We talk about differences in terms of the way Yoshua structured it and all that, but that's not what makes them succeed. That's just, you know, a smart way of couching things to avoid bad PR. But, or maybe he chose two who wouldn't be representatives of everybody, so choosing two is more efficient. Maybe there's that. But really, what's the difference between the failure in Parshat Shlach and the success here?
The expression of the faith at the end here, that they give back a positive report and say, we believe we will be conquered.
Well, that's the conclusion, but what's the catalyst?
The fear of the other
nations.
The fear of the other nation.
Go back
and
to...
They only saw the negative side.
Right.
And that it couldn't be overcome, whereas here, they also saw the negative side. They saw that the people were, afraid of them and were pursuing them. But they still came back with a good report.
Right.
Saying, we can do this.
Right. Making it stronger, though, the original spies had one particular statement that really encapsulated their problem. V'anihi be'einu kachagavim, v'chein hayinu be'einehem. Right? We were grasshoppers in our eyes and in their eyes. And that's when the nation hears that and they start wailing. They say, we can't do it, we can't go in, that's it. The fact that they encounter Rachav, and Rachav doesn't say, we're not afraid of you, but instead Rachav says, we're terrified, is what makes all the difference.
But it's not just her also, it's also the, we said, the king's response.
The king, that's true, absolutely. But even before they get to that, she has given them success. She has given them the hope, and that's what they communicate back to Yehoshua. She gave them the confidence. I think that's really a key point in that, you know, why we view her as being so righteous. Without her, this whole story could have been wildly different.
But
yeah,
I get that all these Mefarshim are interpreting her as this righteous woman. But do we know where they're getting that from? Like, we saw, like, I mean, you can read till the end of the story and. Has she done, like, is there anything that, besides the fact that she comments on God, you know, and she says...
Besides her statement that God is God in the heavens above and on the earth below.
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean...
Makes her righteous.
Right, I mean, there are other people who still believe that there's a God and not necessarily, you know, are Jews or practice or whatever, right? That statement doesn't necessarily make... I mean, like, is there anything else that really indicates why they believe she's so righteous that to be on that level? Like, that, like the level they're putting her on is quite high.
Right. So, I want to go back to what you said. There are other people in the Torah who are good people, who say things like that, who aren't necessarily Jews and doing anything and so on. Name one. There are. Name one. Not just you. Anyway, name one.
Like,
it's true. There are.
Right.
Yisrael.
Right.
Yael.
Right.
Right. Who may be Jewish, but it seems is not. It's from the context. Those are two people we know who do wonderful things, but they're not Jewish. And frankly, from here, I don't have to say that she's Jewish either.
Right.
We're going to talk about her conversion when we get to Parak Vav.
Right.
Yitro also converted.
Yitro, not necessarily. Not necessarily. It's very unclear. Yes, it is extremely unclear, and Yael's status depends on Yitro's status because he is her great great grandfather. The with Yitro, we don't know whether he converted or not.
If
his
wife didn't convert, then it didn't make a difference.
Yitro
wouldn't affect.
He's pre-Matan Torah. Before the Torah is given, any sort of Jewish identity that exists at all is being transmitted paternally. Abraham and Sarah have a child. That child is Yitzchak. Yitzchak is Jewish. They have another child, Yishmael, who's not from Sarah, who's from Hagar, and wanders off. But Abraham wanted him to be in the club, even though was not the mother, even though Hagar was the mother. And it doesn't matter. It's not really paternal, maternal. It's really acceptance of Judaism at Har Sinai.
Well,
so whoever's there,
Hagar
is there.
Whoever's
not, it is now.
Who's it? Hagar, didn't Abram convert her? Or
there's no such thing as conversion.
Well, no.
What do you
mean,
convert to?
But people, I mean, that was what he did, was to bring people, okay, to monotheism, if you like.
Right.
He didn't maybe actually convert them.
Okay. But being monotheistic,
they accepted
it,
and then his son had the Brit.
Yeah. But being monotheistic doesn't mean that you become a Jew. I mean, best example is what you just quoted.
So are we saying that Esau wasn't a Jew?
Yeah. When the Pasuk says...
Well, and in that case, then none of them were Jews.
That's right.
The first Jew
in the sense that we use the word starts at Har Sinai, when you've accepted a covenant. When they travel, when Abraham and Sarah originally travel to Israel and they bring with them Hanefesh Asher Asu B'Charan, right? The people they made, so to speak, in Haran. So the Medrash comments that Abraham was Megayer the Anashim and Sarah was Megayerat the Nashim. That Abraham converted the males and Sarah converted the females. However, two generations later, they're going to go down to Egypt. And we can count all the people who go down to Egypt. And there is nobody there who's not biologically related to Yaakov and his wives and their children. all the people who were taught by Abraham and Sarah are gone. That's not a failure of Abraham and Sarah. It's because there was nothing for them to stick to. They didn't become part of the family. They were taught whatever Abraham and Sarah taught them about there being one God, creator of all, and you should thank God for what you have. And then they go their merry way. There's no, they're not part of something. Becoming part of something only happens once you say Na'aseh v'nishma. There's an agreement with God, and this is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to live, and that's the point where it makes sense to speak in terms of conversion. That's why, or one of the reasons why, the conversion rite that we have matches, as the Gemara notes, what happened at Har Sinai. Meaning, there is an immersion at Har Sinai, and there's an immersion as part of this. The Bris Milah is done before that, when they have the Karban Pesach, but Bris Milah is part of that as well. They brought a karban, a ger is supposed to bring a karban, which without a Beis HaMikdash doesn't happen, and they accept the mitzvos. They say, everything that God demands of us, we will do, and so the ger has to accept mitzvos. But it's that's what it is. It's mass conversion at Har Sinai. Before that, it doesn't really have relevance. But I want to go back to the question that started this.
Did they give the sons of Brit?
Yes, because that goes back to Hashem's command to Abraham, right at the end of Lech Lecha. But going back to where the question started with Yisro and then with Rachav, they're not saying she's Jewish. And Yisro is subject to debate as to whether he's Jewish. One reason why we assume he's not Jewish is because in Parshas Baaloscha, he says, bye, I'm leaving. Right? And Moshe says, no, stay, you're our eyes for us in the wilderness. And he says, yeah, I gotta go. And he leaves. If he's Jewish, why is he leaving? And then, generations later, it was the Haftarah for Zachor, we find the Jews go to war with Amalek, and they're about to go to war, and they send a message to a group of people who are known as the Cani. Cani are descendants of Yisro. And he says to them, listen, move away from Amalek, we're about to go to war with Amalek, and your ancestor Yisro was good to us, we don't want you to get caught up in this, so you get out of the way, and that's what they do. If they are Jewish, why were they living among Amalek? That doesn't work. Imagine your worst sandwich nightmare. Like that, you don't put Jews living with Amalek.
That could have been his descendants before he came over. Don't forget he was well established there before he even came over.
That's interesting. So they're
could have been
like he had seven daughters.
Could have been his kinsmen,
like before he came over.
Right. No, that's a possibility. The same question comes up in terms of Yael, I mentioned before, right? Yael is the one who kills the Canaanite general Sisera, mm-hmm. right? So, on the one hand, we view Yael, right? we view Yael as not Jewish. That's why she's not fighting on behalf of the Jews, and that's why Sisera goes into the tent, because he has no reason not to think that it's 100% safe for him to be there. On the other hand, the Gemara learns halachos from her conduct with Sisera. So it's a little bit odd. It's not simple and straightforward. But the point is that it's entirely possible to say we read her as righteous because of the following ingredients. Number one, her acceptance of God. Number two, she did a good thing. She saved them. Our default is to say nice things about people. So we're going to look at this and interpret it in the most positive way possible. Plus, you can then throw in all these other elements, like the red string, which matches the red string in Eishes Chayil, and the various points that Ralbag and Abarbanel noted. So we see good things in her, and you know, we're happy to say nice things. That's
so
really
why
nice.
Why did she get those as it was? Even special, more special treatment than Yisro or Yael, who also did nice things and who also...
Who said they don't get nice treatment?
They're not put on the same level as her.
That's true.
She's being put as one of the women you're supposed to, you know, like, look up to. Like,
right. And the answer may be, and this is yeah, hypothetical, but...
It could have come from later on when she actually marries Yoshua and becomes the person right. who she becomes at that point, like, or is it all because of what they're seeing here?
And that's what I was thinking, is that maybe it's tied to that.
Right.
Maybe that's...
But do we ever see her after she, like, did she come up after that?
Nope. We know nothing.
So how do we think that she married Yoshua?
Well, you have to wait for Parak Vav.
Also, because it's like Noah.
Like Noah, you know, it's relative also to who's around him. Maybe part of that is, she's done wonderful things.
Well, Noah has his own... I don't want to get into Noah, because we'll never finish with Noah. There's a lot to say about Noah. But
just go watch the movie.
The right. The but there are various people like this in Torah. I mean, you can go all the way back to Malki Tzedek and talk about Malki Tzedek, who comes to Avram and gives Avram a bracha. You can think about Rus before she converts to Judaism. And yeah, and her standing. Like, we have plenty of people like this in the Torah, and you're right. We're elevating.
Also, like, she, we see the conversion, we see what she does afterwards, but we see sort of right. David Mel comes from it. It's obvious that there's something there. Whereas here, she just goes into oblivion, and yet they're finding all these amazing.
Well, like, maybe it's like just in comparison to everyone else around.
Could be, it just seems like a much stronger feeling that they're having, and I'm wondering where they're finding it from, like from the
Yeah, but I think that's what I'm given. I think
but
is what
pretty
is what there
pivotal.
Is.
Right.
It's very pivotal what she does.
Right.
And there's also what you have here spelled out more clearly than with either Yisro or Yael, is the tshuva idea. Mm-hmm. It's much more clear here with Yael. We don't get any insight.
We don't know
there.
That they had the past. Yisro,
we do. Yisro. He's Kohen Midyan.
Right.
So with Yisro, we don't. Yael, we don't. But with Yisro, we are familiar with the fact that he's a Midianite priest until he decides not to be a Midianite priest. So there is the element of tshuva, but the truth is Yisro is elevated. He gets a parsha.
Right.
Right? We didn't call it by Yisro. Of course, so does, you know, Balak. But the point is that Yisro, I think, Yisro is given a lot.
Yeah.
Right. So I think, Ruth's got a book. So I think what I'm going to do is pause with this here. Rather than start the ethnic cleansing discussion, God willing, next week we will start the conversation about ethnic cleansing. Yeah.